Welcome back to Co-op Radio 102.7 FM CFRO. This is Hidden from History. I am the guest host. My name is Reginald Angus Argue. I'm filling in for Kevin Annette for a little while. Eventually he's going to go over to the Vatican to go visit the Pope and give a message from the survivors of the residential schools. And we really look forward to updates from Kevin. At the same time, we're going to continue on our series exposing what's been happening to a few foster care children. Actually, we have one survivor right now who was in the Maple Center, and his name is Dan. Dan, could you introduce yourself and tell us a little bit about yourself?
Hi, I'm Dan. I grew up in Vancouver, Burnaby, Coquitlam, Maple Ridge. Tend to move around pretty quick when you're in care. I was apprehended, I guess, when I was about 3 years old. And that continued with temporary, off and on, different foster homes, on average about 4 a year. By the time I was 13, it was 36 foster homes. And I think that's definitely up there, but that I think that continues today, definitely continues today in those numbers. 36 by the time I was 13. And then they finally made the decision to make me what's called a permanent ward. So thanks for having me here this afternoon.
Well, thank you so much for coming in. What I wanted to do is just have our listening audience to find out from a survivor, you know, what it was like in the Maple Center, because West is telling us so many things, you know, and we just want to basically just hear from a survivor at the same time, and then we're going to have West also share a little bit too. But, you know, what were conditions like within the Maple Center for the children?
I guess if you've seen One Over Forever, the Cuckoo's Nest, and you see all the just people behaving badly, that's pretty much what it is. But, it's kids go in there and they might have problems, but they certainly go in there and they certainly have a lot more problems than when they come out than when they went in. I mean, it's Willingdon North, it's Willingdon and Canada Way, right on the Burnaby border, Burnaby-Vancouver border. And they call it a closed center. It's a in-custody center, but pretty easy to get out of there, go on an outing, just take off. And if you're good enough, you can just ask to leave and take off for days at a time. And groups of us would go out drinking and partying and whatever.
And also, you were telling me that you actually had a friend. Her name was Sasha.
Yeah.
Could you tell our listening audience what happened?
She was the first suicide at the Maples. No friends of hers from high school. I still know today. I knew her from in there. She was going through a rather difficult time in her life, and substance abuse is quite common amongst children who go in the Maples, and things such as prostitution, kids in gangs, everything, you name it. It's almost like a school to learn how to not behave, but. Sasha had her own set of problems, and I guess it was too much for her. And early in the morning, under the guise of a smoke break, she took a cord from an extension cord and from a ghetto blaster and took her own life. And she had timed it. She was on 5-minute watches, and she had timed it, and it was something she was determined to do. And that was the first suicide at the Maples, and I understand Serena Fry was the second.
And also, you're talking about were the drugs actually brought in by some of the staff members?
I didn't use drugs then. I was not any kind of drug user back then. I pretty much just did booze, but not that I know. But I can certainly tell you that I knew staff who were, you know, chronic drug users. But you know, that was their business and of no concern to me. So I didn't pay attention to that. But myself, no, I haven't had experience with that there, but I'm, you know, it's hard to say.
And also with were there an awful lot of basically, you know, sex happening between the different children that were there?
Oh yeah, absolutely, yeah.
So how
I mean,
young?
You get a bunch of children that behave badly, and well, as young, I mean, the age groups in there go from 11, 12 to 17. So I mean, it's.
So it could be someone that was 11 years old.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, absolutely. That was pretty common. 12 years old, I think, was the 12 to 17 was pretty much the age group in there.
So all the listening audience out there, you mean if you have young kids that are that age, Can you imagine your kid acting like that? I mean, that's one question. You know, if you can't, then what happens is you should be appalled that an institution like this was allowed to exist. And, you know, what happens is I call upon people that you have to start calling CKNW, asking Bill Good, are you going to finally talk about this? Because this really needs to be talked about. And also, Dan, you know, what was the one thing that actually you took out of that institution of your stay within there? What is the one thing that basically that you basically took from it?
What did I take from it? More problems, I guess. I had more emotional problems when I came out of there than when I went in there. To say what good came out of it, I really would have to really search real deep for that. Insight in how two institutions work, I guess that was my first big institution sort of experience. But I will say that there's one thing I want to say that was a huge problem there, and I suspect it's a huge problem now, is and it's predominantly with young girls that go in there, is the prostitution is phenomenal. You get guys going down there, cruising out front on Willingdon by the bus stop, their tricks, looking for, I mean, these are the girls' dates looking for them, cruising right out front of Willingdon because they know they're in there. And they know that as soon as they can get AWOL, that they're going to be right back out on the street again. I was spotting for girls when I'm 15 years old. I'm spotting for girls, which is basically writing down tricks plates in case something happens to them. You know, I can go and have some kind of recourse. So,
well, I mean, Wes was telling us how that actually there was a pimp that would be picking up his prostitute that was working for him, you know, right from the Maple Center. I mean, you know, Wes, you were talking about that.
Yeah, that was. The actual parents were so fed up with this because every time the girl, and it was before my time, but when the girl would be at the Maples, every night the guy was coming to get her, and that's documented again in the Vancouver newspapers. So they took this story back then, but now they won't touch it.
And also, Dan, what was a typical night at the Maple Center? Could you describe it for a listening audience?
I can't remember a heck of a lot of it. Wow, that's... I tried to avoid the place as much as possible. I tried to find other things to do out of the center. Pretty much dinner. They tried to keep people really calm. You're getting your pharmaceuticals to calm you down, of course. Ritalin, like you wouldn't believe, probably the main prescription out of that place. I don't know, you're pretty much, if you've been rowdy, if you've been rough, if you're just lippy, they'll lock you in your room probably around 8, 9 o'clock and, you're woken up at about 7 o'clock. So
when you're locked in your room, is actually there a toilet in the room too?
Oh no, nothing like that. You got to bang on the door, And if they're in their room, and the door is the typical, you got the one, 3/4 foot by 3/4 foot window and the deadbolt, and you have a bed which is basically cement with woods on the side to hold the mattress in, and a counter. There's a window, but you can't really. It's dirty plexiglass, so there's nothing else in that room.
Is there a sheet and a mattress?
Oh, yeah, a sheet and a mattress. But, I mean, for youth with mental illness who are trying to heal and trying to, facilitate positive change in their lives, it's absolutely the worst possible atmosphere that any child, and, these are children, and even, 17 years old and you've got mental health, you're probably more of a child than a normal 17-year-old. And this is absolutely not the environment and not the way that... children should be so-called cared for under the care of the ministry.
And also, Wes, you were telling me, you and I were talking last week, and you were mentioning something about 90% of the people that are overdosing here downtown in the East Hastings, actually you could trace them back to the foster care.
Well, that was actually a quote made by he was the director, Fred Bannon, one of the founders. Now, there's Fred's history out of Ontario, I believe, is kind of sketchy as well, but it was his actual statements. He had said that 90% of the overdoses that you're seeing downtown Vancouver, at one point or another, they had some kind of involvement with these people as youth. So I'm not sure where he got his stats from, but that's a quote he used out of the newspapers.
And what were some of the programs that actually were given to the children that were in the Maple Center in regards to helping them, to make it seem like that they were trying to help the child?
Little or nothing. It was basically unit staff that would, you'd sit down in a group. It would be called group, and you'd sit down in a group for maybe an hour, a couple days of work or a couple days a week. For the most part, you were attending the Maple School, which is an on-site school, about 5-6 classrooms, and it was I mean, how do you teach a bunch of kids that are definitely not wanting to be taught? I don't know. That's a difficult one. As for programs, there was very little. It was mostly recreational outings and whatnot. So as far as therapeutic programs to facilitate, healing, there was very little. That's what astounded me about the whole place, is there was little or nothing to facilitate positive change in kids.
And also, like, what were the people that were working in there? What were their training background? I mean, Wes has actually explained a little bit of his training background, but what was the average staff's training background anyway?
I thought a lot of them were still going to school, sort of thing. Either they were working part time and they were going to school. Some of them had no school other than, they're built. Basically, if you can handle a kid, if you can pin a kid on the ground, you got a good chance of getting hired. So, I don't know. I wasn't working there, so I don't know what qualifications they had.
And you actually saw abuse happening towards the children from the staff point of view? Does staff actually do it to the child?
I mean, as for restraining kids and whatnot, absolutely. I mean, if one or two staff aren't able to restrain a kid, then, that's the old school of thought, is just basically beat them into submission. And that was pretty common there. I mean, it's...
What were some of the injuries that do you remember any of the injuries that were, that any of the children were subjected to?
I don't know. I don't remember any offhand. I don't. I've got some serious memory issues around that place. I mean, it's tough to remember some of those things. There's some pretty horrible things.
Yeah, it's just that, what you're telling me, you're saying there's an awful lot of stories that need to get out. And I mean, that's what, I thank Kevin and Annette for allowing us to have this chance to start addressing this issue, because the residential schools are extremely important, but we also have to remember that the people that are non-native, they also suffer just as much as the natives in regards to the foster care system, and we have to start addressing that. I mean, the only way we're going to have a positive future is if we say to our government, this is what you've done to the children in the past, and this is the children that have been hurt, and start talking about the stories and allow them to talk. And that way we're able to finally learn from it and make sure it never happens again. West, I got a quick question to ask you. You've listened to what Dan has to say. What are your thoughts? Like, you're telling us what you saw, but what are your thoughts on what Dan's saying?
Well, it's interesting because you've heard me talk about some of these things. The Maples, is the technical term that they describe as the Maples Adolescent Treatment Center. But for a while, they took the T out of the title. Now it's back in again. There's a lot of assessment. And what it is a lot of times you'll actually sit there and you'll have all the disciplines in the room. And they put this big package together that goes back to the community. And so many times the communities will say, well, this doesn't help us work with the kid. It's just a whole bunch of, it's just a pile of paper. The therapeutic stuff, I had two psychiatric nurse students say to me one day, they looked at me and they said, you realize you're the only staff we've ever seen try to counsel these kids? And that was quite a profound statement that was made, because around there it was a free for all. And when I hear Dan saying some of these stories, you got to understand that his friend Sasha hung herself before Serena Fry. And so then they get to the Serena Fry story, and then they say we're going to make changes. But you already should have made them before. And it was interesting because Dan told me that. That woman that was buried, you can't find any information. I found one article about what happened to Sasha, and it's a pretty vague article. So my point is, then Serena, her situation happens. They say, we're gonna make changes. So how did the boy that we were working with, how did he dive off the overpass? How did that happen? And it's interesting because in the Serena Fry case, they kept saying, oh, there was always this contradictions throughout the press. The first aid say there were no indications that she was suicidal. And then they come out and you got an aunt saying she was in the hospital previously for 2 weeks because she tried to do things to herself and she missed her grandmother's funeral. And then they start talking about reports where Serena had a history of this. But yet she gets let out on a Friday evening to go wander around the city by herself. So here's the same pattern. If it happened once, Sasha should have been the red light. Didn't. Dan even told me about a story of a girl who, and I heard about this one, she burned the place down.
Can you share a little bit about that story there, Dan?
Well, I wasn't there on the unit. I was actually in the unit that replaced the unit that was burnt down. So all the kids that were in the unit that burnt, which I think was what was called CATC or CAT2, burnt down. They moved all the kids to CAT1, and they moved a bunch of the kids to what is called Inman House, which is, I believe it's Elizabeth Fry run group home, and they actually, the ministry was using it from them and paying them to use it until the other one was fixed. I mean, the place was just created delinquent behavior more than it helped. I mean, kids, we'd AWOL to, you know, under the Willingdon overpass, and we'd be having fires, drinking booze, sex, and everything. And I'm not saying I didn't mind it as a kid, but I am saying it's probably inappropriate for kids who are supposed to be getting help. So,
I heard that on top of the Maple Center, Wes was telling me that actually there's places, there's blankets all over there where the kids were having sex.
On the roof. Around Discovery Park, the industrial park up the road. BCIT was just amazing. The kids would just go in there and break into buildings and steal cars out of there, break into their studio, steal audio visual equipment, and just go have a heyday. Just astounding.
You know, one question I have for you is that, you know, what damage do you feel that this has done to your life, and now as an adult, looking back at the, you know, how the treatment that you received at the...
I wouldn't say the Maples. I'd say it's systematic of the entire ministry period. I mean, the Maple is just an extreme end of how the ministry works. I mean, between 2003, 2007, 81 kids in care had committed suicide, and that doesn't even account...
81?
81, yeah, between 2003, 2007, and that's from the BC Coroner Service. 81 children, and all these reports and recommendations, there's no action, there's no change. Okay, we created a separate ministry, so basically they have welfare for kids now by having the Ministry of Children and Families. You know, if there's any real meaningful change in the system, we'd see it. We'd see it on our streets. I mean, I walk out of here, and I guarantee I'm going to see four or five walking through the skids to the bus depot. I'm going to see four or five people that I used to know from in care. Guarantee it, because, I mean, it happens every time. You know, I come to visit my mom, who lives pretty much right next door. And
it looks like Molly wants to ask a question. Go ahead, Molly.
Yeah. Hey, Dan. Can you hear me? You're going to see two, four or five of your friends on your way to the bus stop. I'm just curious. You did come out. You can't hear me. Oh.
Well, actually, we're going to, you know, Molly, can we throw in a quick PA and then we'll come back?
Sure.
Because we got to adjust the equipment in here. Cooperative 102.7 FM, CFRO. It's hidden from history. We'll come back in a couple seconds and we'll get you to the ASEC. Welcome back to Co-op Radio, 102.7 FM, CFRO. This is Hidden from History. I'm the guest host. My name is Reginald Angus-Argue. I'm archiving this on hiddenfromhistory.org. I'll also be archiving this on my website of angus-mcleod.com. Molly, right before break, you wanted to ask Dan a question. Go ahead.
I do want to. Dan, I applaud you. Applaud you for stepping up to the microphone. And I think that the healing has begun with you and talking, and I see that my reaction in hearing all the horrors that you are bringing up, that Reg is drawing out of this interview, it brings up fear and anger in people, which is a motivator to make change for these institutions that are failing. But also, you were about to say you're on your way out of here. You probably walk down the street and see a few of your buddies that you knew that you grew up with through this institution. And there's something right there that I wanted to ask you about in the strength that toughness and the camaraderie that you got out of watching out for each other in the context of neglect that you've lived through. What can you see a way to turn that into instead of a life of, like some, you said you're going to school to learn how to be a criminal, you're also learning a few other things too, I'm sure. Can you turn that, any of it, like the buddies that you see, that you check them out and say, hey, how's it going? Do you guys get to a level of speaking about?
Yeah, absolutely. I know when I see, you know, I'll just, an example, just call him John, you know, when I see him down here often, And, you know, I got to sit down. It's like, geez, you know, I haven't seen you, and it's been a couple of years now. So let's go for coffee. Let's go sit down. What are you doing with your life? I mean, you're down here, so I can understand part of that. You don't have to tell me anything. Just tell me, you know, what you did today and how your family is, or tell me whatever you want. But let's go sit down and have a coffee. So, I mean, yeah, it's people you want to know them for the rest of your life, you know, for good or bad. So I think that's part of it is looking out for
friends. And the other thing that pops to my head is, you know, in you hear that abused become abusers, and people who are, you know, sexually abused as a youth often grow into habits and horrors and never quite twist their way around their identity and loving themselves enough to have a healthy sexual relationship, relationship. What can you like? Do you think that you'll ever have? Do you ever have a hope that through art or something that you could you could help other people with finding their both feet on the ground and feeling like they love themselves again?
Yeah, well, I mean, it starts with me. If I'm ever to, you know, to get in a relationship with a partner or anything like that, absolutely, it's got to start with me first. I've got to, you know, there's got to be healing, and there has to be positive change for, you know, for me to be a better person, to be where I want to be.
About the stuff that goes on in foster homes and stuff.
Well, it's not nurturing for the most part. It's quite negative. I mean, so especially the group homes and places like the Maples. It's quite the contrary. You know,
did those adults that are screwing up? What did they go through? Like, where, you know, the cycle, you could trace it right back. But you know, we got to break the cycle. That's what I'm interested in.
Yeah, well, I found a lot of the staff there were quite, you know, nonchalant about the whole thing. It wasn't their problem. It was a job. They're just trying to pay rent and. It didn't seem like it was their concern totally, so I don't know what to say to that.
Well, one thing I'm finding with the chance that we've actually had to talk is that we're telling the listening audience what's really going on. I mean, it's basically horror stories, but at the same time, it's reality. And people have to basically realize that reality sometimes is based in horror, you know, and basically through telling the truth, then what happens is we're teaching the people about the truth. Therefore, people are forced to look at it and ask themselves, well, how can we correct the situation so another child like Sasha, like Serena Fry, like so many other, do not have to pass away before their time? Because these are youth. These are children. You know, and if you're not getting angry about the fact of a child dying here, well, then what happens is you should seriously question your soul. Because I'm very angry about the fact that the children are dying here. This is our future. And if we don't get angry about it and we don't demand changes, then what's going to happen to us? What kind of future are we going to have? Wes, you wanted to add a couple questions?
Well, it's interesting the way Molly was talking, because that is the key. First, you have to get the light on it. Once you get the light, you know the areas that need to be changed, concerned, or in this case, you probably might going to have to clean house. But Dan already has the foundation just by building those relationships, by going for a coffee with the guy. You have to have an inroad. They spent a whole life of being judged. The programs I ran in the Fraser Valley, the alternate school system, those are the highest profile kids that we had in the Fraser Valley. We couldn't keep up with the requests. Rotary clubs, YMCAs, camps. We couldn't keep up with the people that were asking for these kids to come and help them. The kids served the community. It was unbelievable. So then when I go into Abbotsford and I'm the community service officer with probation, again, 85% of all assigned hours were completed, and the kids were waking up. The adults were waking up. This isn't hard to do, but you got to listen. And unfortunately, our system isn't about that. A lot of times it's only about the dollar. And I know Dan and I talked about that earlier. It's funny because he came out with that almost immediately. There's so much money involved here.
I wanted to quickly read a point. What happened was, our March 8th show on 2010, where Wes and I were on the show, we actually received a compliment out of it. Basically, the person's name is Janet. Thank you so much. Thank you for informing the Canadian public about the Maple Schools. I strongly believe that Bill Good and the CKNW Orphan Fund needs to clean up their act. Exposing the adults who ran the Maple School is a way for adults with disabilities who used to be served by the CKNW Orphan Fund to contribute their voices to demand better public accountability to all BC professionals who serve children. Thank you so much for writing that in there, Janet. I mean, that really made it all worthwhile because, you know, when we do radio, we volunteer here at Co-op Radio, but it's a listening audience that actually send us stuff afterwards that really makes it worthwhile because we're giving our time because we want to make sure that the children in the future will basically have a better life. The people get informed. It looks like we have a caller. Hello, caller?
Yes, you do have a caller. Reg, Bob here. Don't expect too much from Bill Good. He's not the type who wants to make waves. I remember years ago when Rafe Mayer was on CKNW, he was not afraid to stir things up, but good old Bill, he would play it safe.
Yeah, I already called Bill Good out.
Well, the thing is, he'd be worried that if he got some official on that he would never get that same person on again. But anyway, I just have a quick word for Dan. Is he still there?
Yeah, yes. Bob, it's good to hear you. Good afternoon.
Yeah, gobble gobble. I heard you on the air this morning, and I'll tell you what, I won't tie this up, but maybe we'll catch you on the 4 o'clock go around if you're there.
Okay, Bob. Yeah, I'd like to go for coffee soon. Okay, thanks for
calling. Okay, thanks, Dan, and thanks, Rich. Keep it up.
Thank you so much for calling in. And you know, Dan, can you actually tell the listening audience, you know, what changes do you want to see come out of what the people?
Well, I mean, the ministry has to change. The ministry has to change drastically. The way they've been apprehending kids and giving them back to the parents and then realizing things with the parents aren't changing, so they apprehend kids again. I mean, you get kids that are on an average going in and out of foster homes, in and out of placements, you know, 4 times a year. That there's no possible way that child can grow up to be a productive part of any community. It's simply not possible, both the mental health problems that develop strictly because of that system that isn't working properly. I mean, it compounds itself drastically. It creates a huge problem that creates, I mean, in itself, if they would deal with, I don't know what the solution is and how to deal with it. It's not something you can throw money at, but a lot of it starts with poverty. You know, you get parents that are incapable of looking after their children because they're only, you know, two parents or one parent's making $8 an hour and landlords are taking 3/4 of that, and then it's impossible. It's absolutely impossible for people to better themselves. So what does the ministry do? The ministry apprehends the child. And what does the ministry do? They pay a foster parent who is basically running a business. The foster parent's getting several thousand dollars a month to look after a child. And, you know, you get foster parents that have two homes and they're paying their mortgages through the foster system. And it's a business for them. You know, they don't work. They haven't worked in, you know, so many years. And it's absolutely a business. These contracts for children's and they see gold when they see special needs kids. They just see dollar signs in their eyes, and they're just laughing all the way to the bank. And I'm not saying that good foster parents shouldn't be remunerated for providing good homes, but I say definitely a lot of these homes are not good homes. And I don't know, as a child in care, when you're in a bad home, there's almost no recourse you can take. You can say, this person slaps me around. You know, they're drinking and boozing it up. They're having, swing parties in the bloody living room. And, that's not appropriate for children to grow up in a good home and to grow up to be productive parts of the community. And these are people that are getting paid to look after these children. There's great foster homes out there, but I would say there's a huge number that aren't, and that is just the ministry does nothing about that. There's no recourse when you're a child in care for the ministry to unless you got obvious bruising, you know, or broken bones or anything like that, and even then.
Well, also you're talking about a psychologist. Last name is Kwan.
Oh yeah, well, Dr. Kwan from the Maples. Yeah, I didn't see any. I mean, the Maples to me just seemed like a warehouse where kids are held. Sooner they get old enough that they're not in care, they're not our problem anymore. So, I don't know. It's a doctor I saw once a month, and he didn't seem to do much of anything.
So. Only once a month.
Yeah,
that's for about it. How long?
Oh, I don't know. 10 minutes.
10 minutes, yeah. For once a month.
Yeah, I would think so. That's about it. Yeah.
And Wes, you were actually going to tell us a little bit about Dr. Kwan?
Well, yeah, I knew Dr. Kwan as well. And there's a couple things that I'm probably not going to get into right now because they're pretty deep. But what I will talk about is there was a report, the Serena Fry, and the Maypoles did an internal report, and Dr. Kwan actually gave that report. Now, what's interesting about Dr. Kwan is that he, there was a 5-page report, and in that report, 3 pages were completely blank. This is what was released to the press and the public. 1 page, I believe it had 3 lines on it, and the other page had a line saying staff is not liable for this, and that was it. So out of 5 pages, 3 are actually blank. This is it again, the secrets. Dan was saying earlier when he got his file from the Maples, you may want to ask him about this. I was dumbfounded listening to this. So,
yeah. Go ahead, Dan.
Yeah, well, this is the file for my entire, while I was in care, from while I was 13 till the day I turned 9, from when I was 3, pardon me, till the day I turned 19. And it was a foot thick and 3/4 black felt pen. And it left me, you know, it was probably something I shouldn't have looked in at the time. Probably something I never should have bothered to get ever. But most of it was black felt pen. I mean, that is social workers, that is foster parents, that is my own mother, myself to a degree. Programs I was in, that was all deleted. It was basically very little useless. It left a lot more questions than it answered, and it a lot of it was people protecting their own butts. I mean, so a lot of it is
are just, you actually close to your mother at this time, or
well, I've always been, you know, known my mother and fairly close. She lives very, very close to here, about a half block away, she's just recently got into social housing. I mean, that, as we know, for anybody is really hard to get down here. So, yeah, it's tough. I mean, it amazes me how especially, you know, social workers within the ministry are social workers. I mean, they're the whole title is loaded. These people just seem to be more interested in their own careers and more interested. I mean, there's got to be good ones out there, but they seem to be more interested with their own careers and crossing their I's and T's so that they can get a promotion up into the ministry. It's tough.
So they're
to
putting their bank book as basically as number one.
Well, I would say the majority.
And the children
of them,
is second.
The majority of them, yeah. I'm sure a lot of them go in there hoping to do good when they're, you know, going through school and whatnot. But I think when reality hits, they just duck and cover.
One thing, out of fairness to the social workers, a lot of them get pretty frustrated. And again, if you see the intimidation and the secrets and keep your mouth shut around the Maples and areas like that, they're in the same boat. A lot of them, it's like, pay the mortgage or you're done. You know, your career will be taken. And when I can actually, I spoke to the head of the Social Workers Association. I've known the man for years. And he was actually on the front page of the Vancouver papers. They were going to fire him, Paul Jenkinson. So he starts the Social Workers Association. Unfortunately, it's starting to look that he was doing it just to cover himself, to save himself. Because when I told him about the Maples, his response was incredibly disappointing. And then a couple of years later, while he's going back to get his master's degree, he's working part-time on the Zenith 1234 line. And he asked me one night, what is going on in there? Every night we get calls out of that place. What is happening? And I look at him and I say, I already told you about this stuff. And to this day, nothing. And I actually mentioned Paul Jenkinson in the Agora story.
What about this Paul Ramsey?
Well, that was the health minister for the NDP at the time. Now, it's interesting because when I went to Carol James trying to get help, and I showed Carol James the actual photos of foster care, Carol James actually went and she got Paul Ramsey. And when, like, he's retired, he walked away from politics, but she went and got Paul Ramsey, and I believe the newspaper article says something to the sense of she was going to hire him as advisor so he could tell her what to tell the people so they would vote for her. So there's another roadblock where all these little skeletons in that back room, and here you are trying to protect the kids, and you have no idea that these people had this history until I started digging further recently. Then these names keep popping up. And it's on both sides of the fence, because when the Liberals were in opposition, there's Colin Hanson, Colin Farrell Hanson, I believe is how they described his name, demanding an inquiry into these things. But yet I go to them when they're in power, nothing. Is this a play? Is this theater? What is it?
Dan, you were in basically foster care for, you know, almost 16 years.
Yeah.
During that time, you know, we've had changes from the NDP to the social credits to the Liberals. you know, did you see any difference within the system as the government changed? Did you see any changes happening within the system?
No, not really. Changes in boundaries. When I was in care, a social worker had an average between 40 and 50 kids on his caseload. That's one social worker looking after 40 to 50 children in his portfolio of you know, that's his care. He's supposed to be responsible for these kids. So, you know, he's got 10 of them are delinquents. They're out running around the streets. They're out boozing and drugging and whatever they're doing. And, I mean, there's no way for a social worker to manage that. It's totally impossible. As far as I know, those numbers haven't changed. So
actually, they'll probably increase now because they're talking about massive budget cuts. Yeah. So you know where the budget cuts are going to happen first. It's going to affect the children.
People can't speak up for themselves. That tends to be where the government, you know, the children don't vote. You know, their parents probably don't vote. You know, it's tough to say that, yeah, absolutely, you know, take money from the people who can't speak up for themselves. I mean, these children, they need to, I mean, what are the social costs? What are the financial costs? What are the costs to the communities later on when these kids aren't looked after properly, when they're under the care of the government? I mean, I would say it's a lot more than, you know, somebody goes to prison. How much does that cost? You know, because these kids are basically growing up being criminals. They grow up, they're an addict. What does that cost? They're breaking into cars so that they can get their fix. But what's the cost when somebody's productive in the community? Well, they put back into the community. They're paying taxes. They're joining community groups, and they're, you know, becoming good people. So,
well, it looks like we have a caller. Go ahead, caller. Hello, caller. Oh, looks like we're okay. We asked the caller to call back. We do apologize about that. But anyway, Dan, I wanted to ask you a question. You know, through all the different foster homes that you went through, did you find, on percentage-wise, how many of the foster homes would you say actually were good foster homes compared to the ones that shouldn't even had been a foster home to begin with?
Well, there was a few of them that definitely shouldn't have been foster parents. There, you know, there was one or two that were really outstanding, really, really good people, and I still talk to them, you know, to this day, of course. They treat them like family. I don't remember, you know, I've got some huge memory issues. I repress a lot of this stuff, absolutely. I can't really remember anything before 8, 9 years old, but, you know, there was a few of them were absolutely, absolutely horrible. You know, I can remember some. I was living in with my mom in a co-op out in the Fraser Valley, and one of the foster homes that I was in that very same co-op. You know, low-income people, they're doing it for the money, and just absolutely horrible. I mean, kids so afraid to come out of the room that the foster parents would yell at them that they'd piss right in the corner of the room without getting out of the room because there's too many kids in the house and everybody's frustrated. So, I mean, you know, the ministry comes for a visit and checks out the foster home, and they know when they're coming, so they know to clean up and make it look good. And you better make it look good as a kid, otherwise you're going to get a beating. So
actually, there's some foster homes that actually would beat the children.
Oh, well, absolutely. You know, physical punishment, absolutely. You know, it's, you know, be it a wooden spoon, and I'm not, you know, absolutely put you over their knee really damn hard, excessively with anger. Absolutely not acceptable for foster parents to be doing that.
Well, actually, Wes was showing me some photos of different places. We were talking about this. Actually, I think it was March 8th we were talking about this. You want to share a little bit with Dan about that?
Well, yeah. The photos, the conditions were horrendous, and they said we couldn't even describe it on the air. But one situation, I actually played Santa Claus for a social service agency, and one of the direct contractors to the government, and that was the agency that ran the group home, the foster home. I'm playing Santa Claus for them. All the directors, they're all there. All the directors are in the room, all the people that are in charge of the program, and all the supervisors. I'm handing out the presents, and when it's all done, in comes one of the ladies, and she's got a stocking for each kid. Now, she's paid for it out of her own pocket, which is against policy as well, sets up staff for favorites, that kind of thing. She hands each kid, and you're talking anywhere from 14 to 17-year-olds. Each kid got a stocking, and in those stockings was two packs of cigarettes and a lighter. What happened to that lady after she did that? And I mean, I complained to the director, and they never got back to me to this day. She got promoted.
She's running the programs and should have been fired, should have been charged, should have been all kinds of things. But there's a prime example.
Well, it looks like we have a caller. Go ahead, caller.
Yes. I was a foster child, but I was one of the fortunate ones. I actually got 12 years of once-a-week therapy for about 7 of that 12 years. And a few things that I learned, there's only two things Strink ever said to me. First, he said, it's up to you now. Second, he would ask, when I was sitting there silent, what would you be doing if you weren't doing these things? And I learned out of all this that it's not that one needs to, wants to, or has to, but it is able to tell anybody what you are feeling right now, especially yourself. Catch yourself in your own denial. Things get better when you decide they will. Have patience. Do nothing in anger except to be aware.
That's great. Thanks for that. You know, I don't consider myself terribly unlucky either. Thanks for that. That was great. I really appreciate that.
Well, they are the essence of what it takes to get back your mental health.
Yeah.
All that.
Yeah, that's a big issue for me, my mental health. It's absolutely paramount right now. It's a really difficult thing to deal with.
Well, Ayn Rand said, if in doubt, examine your precepts.
Yeah.
And, you know, you have to love your enemy, your demons to death.
Yeah. You know, when you said it's up to you now, that was not something that I heard very frequently. All the, you know, decisions were made for me and on my behalf pretty much without consultation. So I'm really glad that you took that and embraced it and took charge of what you had to do.
Well, it took me 7 years over a 12-year period, and I started when I was 15 and finished when I was 27. And I went out right after that and got my pilot's license.
Nice.
And I had the drive. I ended up driving cab in Toronto to finish paying for my flying lessons. These days, I'm an aircraft inspector, mechanic, aircraft owner, pilot.
Yeah, and I mean, that's the exception to the rule. The children who grow up in care and successful is not as common as it should be, that's for
it's
sure.
It's up to you now.
Yeah, yeah.
That's the first thing. It's up to you now. That's the first thing he said, and he kept on repeating that. And when I couldn't say anything, he would say, what would you be doing if you weren't doing these things? Or what would you be talking about if you weren't talking about these things? Because you have to catch yourself in your own lies.
That's great. That's great. Thank you.
Yeah, that's so inspirational.
Yeah. Have a good one.
Thank you so much for calling in. And, you know, Dan, you know, you have a lot of basically inner demons that you said you have to still confront, you know. Do you feel that, you know, over time, as you're getting older and older, do you find you're getting more calm, or do you find that there's still an inner battle inside of you?
Oh, I think I've got a great deal of work to do. Absolutely. A long road to go, but it is getting better. The more I take charge of my life and the more things that I do for myself as a person rather than you know, I'm not used to doing that. I'm not used to saying, you know, I need to go on a hike today to reflect and be quiet and actually going out and doing it. So.
And, you know, do you find that are you still battling alcoholism, or have you managed to stay
sober?
Well,
I mean, no, it's always a problem. It's definitely, I drink a fair bit. So, I mean, it's definitely a way to, not the best way, but it definitely, you know, helps it for a very, very short time. So,
well, I've been sober 8 years now, and you know, I'm a survivor of child abuse. So,
yeah.
You know, it's like I can understand to a certain degree what you've gone through, but you know, you've also gone through more extreme than I've gone through. You know, and there's some of it I find kind of hard to understand. But you know, I'm just trying to tell the people this is what's happening to a certain percentage of our population that we should start caring about, because you know, as I keep harping again and again, it's the children are our future. And if we, the people, don't start recognizing the children are our future, then, you know, how much more are we going to be spending on, you know, institutions, to the jail system and mental institutions and other to take care of this problem in the future, where we could have taken care of it to begin with the teaching the children properly, which treating them fairly as human beings. You know, would you like to comment on that, Dan? Wes?
Well, and there's the key. And by Dan even sitting here today, he's talking.
And once you get the stuff out of you, you start to wake up and you start to grow. But there's an old statement that's used that says, God uses the broken to help and teach others. And I just heard a man here who's done an incredible job. You'd think he was on the radio for years. He's eloquent. His thoughts are there. He's obviously put a lot of thought into this and talking about some of his hobbies. You know, he has those positives in his life as well. But to say that it's still not a struggle, well, that's defeating yourself in itself. And so when I first met him outside, I'm like, this is pretty incredible. And the stories that he's coming out with, not softening it, it's just telling exactly like it is. And a lot of it's reflecting what we've already talked about, but it's coming from the side where the kids were actually involved in the healing has to start. And like I say again, it can be done. And the quickest way to do it, you have to build those relationships. And the interesting thing is, one of the most important things when working with children is one of the most significant things in a child's life is to have a significant adult in their life. And it's amazing to see the connections.
Yeah, it looks like we're starting to run out of time. So, Dan, would you like to leave some last words?
Well, creating the dialogue is great. I mean, it's difficult for me. It brings a lot of, tills the soil of the stuff that I had really tried to bury it, definitely bury it and forget about it. But it's really this past few days thinking about a lot of the stuff that I had been through that I hadn't remembered a lot of it in years. And I suppose in a way that's good to create, dialogue. I can't forget about this. You know, there's parts of me that can't forget about it. I always need to have it on, a certain part of my mind or mostly in my heart to... There has to be dialogue. It can't all be forgotten and swept under the rug because it continues today. And these children need more care than they're getting, and they need more respect than they're getting. And they need, they're not able to look after themselves to the point that the world would like them. But, we have a responsibility as a community to properly look after these children. So,
Wes, would you like to say some last words?
Well, yeah, it's interesting because the exact kids that we had and we're supposed to be able to help. I went through a small community in this province, in the interior, and I pick up the newspaper, and in the most wanted, here's an actual girl that I knew when she was 13. She's now in her 30s, and there she is, most wanted, in the local newspaper in a small community. So this will affect you one way or the other. It will show up. So if we don't deal with it now, like the old statement is, you can spend a dollar today or 10 tomorrow. This isn't hard to do. And I'm sure a lot of these kids have some severe issues. But if you heard some of their stories, you would cry just listening to it. And you go, how did this kid even get this far? And the problem is that you probably come to tears trying to tell the story to somebody. So we're supposed to protect those that can't protect themselves. That's what we're here for. And if you don't, it will cost you. It will cost us as a society. It will cost people. So once you clean the house, you start addressing these issues, then it's time for the healing. But you can't do it to get rid of the roadblocks.
Yeah, I'd like to basically say thank you so much for coming in there, Dan, because you're an inspiration to so many people. Yeah, you've lived through the abuse, and by you coming forward, you're what you're doing is you're saying, yes, this did happen. So, everything that Wes has been sharing with me, you're sitting there going, yeah, you're giving it from the standpoint of a survivor. And, people like yourself should basically be inspirations for all of us. Well,
I mean, there's lots of people I know that went through much more horrendous things than I went through. And, I wouldn't, my experiences are my experiences. They are what they are, there's other kids out there going through way worse right now. And that's where my heart is right now, is these kids, they don't deserve to go through that. And they need to...
The mic is always open to them, as long as I'm covering for, until Kevin gets back.
Yeah, it's good work. Thanks for having
me. Hopefully Kevin will take over and continue on this, because there's so many stories. Like you've told me, Janet's told me, Wes has shared with me. There's so many kids out there that need healing. And that's what we should be doing, is using this time, radio time, to tell people like Mr. Good, to tell people within the mainstream media, if you're not going to talk about it, we will provide an outlet for the children to talk.
Yeah, voting for specific political parties or anything like that isn't going to change the system. It's a fundamental problem with the system. It starts in the roots of the system, the ministry, and there needs to be massive, massive change if these children are going to get the proper care that they need.
And Wes, it looks like we have about 30 seconds left. Do you want to leave the last words?
Well, it's tough to follow that up because he's pretty much said it in a nutshell.
If you do what you did, you're going to get what you got. We all know the old statement of the definition of insanity is keep doing the same thing over expecting different result. Well, this is a prime example. It's the most messed up ministry this province has ever had. And repeatedly, one minister after another, there's just a musical chairs in there.
Well, thank you so much for coming on, Dan. Thank you again for coming in, Wes. This is Co-op Radio 102.7 FM. Is hidden from history. Until I'm back again next week, I say to all the listening audience, have a great day.